accommodation with a fellow named Reg Mitchell of the PPCLIs. He was a weapon training officer there. And I was on very good terms with the Strathconas. A fellow named Connolly was the CO, and Harvey, the BC, was a major. And Devey was another major. And
would Perks be there at that time?
No. That was all the cavalry, the Strathcona. But Bradbrook, I knew. I'd seen Bradbrook the year before in Winnipeg. But commander of the 4th Division, 4th Armored Division.
Oh, Worthington?
No.
In the First World War?
In Italy.
Fifth Armored.
Oh dear, pardon? No.
No, not Tommy Burns.
He was a Strathcona man. I knew him quite well. And I remember we used to take equitation at 8 o'clock in the morning out in the cold parade ground.
What was your...
Harry Foster.
Oh, Harry Foster. Oh, yes. Yeah. What was your own rank, by the way, when you became a signal officer?
I was a lieutenant. I hadn't passed my examinations for captain. And I took some here. And I don't think I got them until another year or so somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
There was no chance of getting a captain much anyway.
Yeah.
But that was a very pleasant interlude out there.
Yeah.
And Colonel Spry was the AQMG, and the fellow named Major Cock. Harry Cock was the GSO. He had been an instructor at RMC before that.
Yeah.
And Billy Gibson was the brigadier.
Uh-huh.
And Dan Spry was in knee pants in those days.
Oh my God.
And his older brother Graham was off at Oxford.
Yeah. Good Lord.
And I used to go up and I had the militia training classes, and would go up to take examinations and for cadet exam, COTC examinations, in at the University of Edmonton, and then there was the militia summer camps out at Camp Sarcee.
Yeah,
I took one of those courses. And
you would have a mess by this time, presumably. You belong to
the Strathcona I belong to the Strathcona, really.
Yeah. Did you join any other organizations at this time?
Here?
Back in the 1920s, for example, Kiwanis or Rotary?
No.
No,
I was too much of a roving character in those days.
Yeah.
And then I went down from... I was here about a year. And then I went down and... I've forgotten the exact chronology of the... the events, I know then a whole group of us went to London for an infantry training course.
Oh.
Colonel Ford thought we should go and have some infantry training and get indoctrinated to mess etiquette in one of the senior messes and so on. So we went to London. There wasn't anybody lived in there.
Yeah.
The only person who lived in there was an attached NPM officer by the name of Charlie Fowkes.
Oh, God's sake.
So we were all senior to him, really.
Yeah.
I was a senior, and there was Harold Tabor, who'd come back from the Yukon by that time. And I think there was Carl McCullough, and there was Frank Owens, and Burgess, I guess, and Hal Clough, something like that.
Yeah.
And there were no troops. We trained with ropes most of the time.
This is London, Ontario.
London, Ontario.
Yeah, and that's RCR, isn't it?
RCR.
Yeah.
That was a waste of time.
Yeah. Did you live in, by the way?
Yes, we lived in.
Yeah. And who was to teach you some of this etiquette? Just Charlie Fowkes or what? Oh dear. I can put that one.
You read very good books of Charlie Fowkes.
Well, God almighty. But you mentioned there are few troops now.
Oh, they have.
I remember in the 20s and in the 30s, the strength of the permanent force units was very small, and they had companies scattered about, too, didn't they? Yeah.
Well, the RCRs had one there, and had one company there, and I don't know where the other would be. They had one in Toronto, I guess.
Yeah.
Probably one in Toronto. The RCDs had one in Toronto.
Yeah.
And
just to go back for a moment, sometime, I think it was in the 1920s, wasn't one of the signalers, maybe it was Frank Riddell, who's involved in this famous case of the mad trapper.
Oh yes, it was Frank.
Yeah, what was the score there? Do you remember anything about that? Or maybe you weren't there at the time, I don't know.
Well, I was. Now, when was it?
About the mid-20s, I think.
He was at a Clavick.
Yeah.
He was at a Clavick. And another fellow named Hershey was there.
Yeah.
And the senior NCO was a fellow named Neary.
Mm-hmm.
Nash Neary, we called him. IH were his initials, I don't know what it's what. But Neary was a senior one, and he sent down the adjutant of the corps in Ottawa, because the Colonel Ford was not only the assistant director of signals, he was the officer administering the corps.
Yeah.
In other words, it was a self-administering unit. He looked after the promotions and the postings and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Through other channels in the NDHQ, but he was responsible for it. Well, Fairfax Weber was the quartermaster at the store in our stores in Ottawa. He looked after all the purchasing and the distribution of the stores to all these stations around there. It was all done centrally through Ottawa.
Yeah.
And he undertook to write a bulletin, a monthly bulletin, for news around, and it was sent all around. And Neary at Clavick was a very good correspondent, and he wrote up the story of that thing there from beginning to end in and was published in several pages in the bulletin.
Yeah.
And I lost, through traveling around here and there and all over the country, I lost track of a lot of some of my things like that, including that, the bulletin.
Yeah.
But when Bill Lockhart was director of signals, he republished that in the militia or the Army Journal.
Canadian Defense Journal.
No.
Wasn't that
it? Well, it was some kind of a journal. It wasn't the Defense Quarterly. It was a small different format on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he republished that in full. And I came across some people, now a chap here in Calgary, Art Child, who's head of Burns Food, he was a signaler, was a cadet attached at Camp Borden in the years about somewhere around 1930 or 1928, I don't know which.
Yeah.
And then later on he was in Toronto in the militia there in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But he was at Borden when Bunny Weeks was the CO there.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that he was just a cat's whisker as an administrator or an executive. And he used to go around saying so too. Mm. So he gave a lecture. He was a guest speaker at one of our reunion dinners, Signal's reunion dinners in Toronto here about 3 years ago. And so I'd never met him, but I was sitting next to George Isbister, one of the old boat timers, and he told me about this, that he was a great fan of Buddy's, and he would probably speak about him, and he certainly did too. So I went up to him afterwards and I said that I would be seeing Bunny in a few days. Bunny was just on his way to Florida and I was just going down there. So I said I would tell him that I'd seen you. And well, then we had some other interests in common. He didn't have enough cuss words without using them to say about Canada Packers. He'd been an accountant with Canada Packers, I judged.
Yeah, that's right.
So I said to him, well, I can understand your affair with Canada Packers, because my wife's best friend was a daughter of James Harris.
Yeah.
And the Harris Abattoir amalgamated with Gunn to form Canada Packers.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that there wasn't much love lost between her family and the old J.S. McLean.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I said, he says, I know her. He says, I see her every time I go to Toronto. So we had something in common.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. I didn't know that he had been a Signaler. I'd met Child myself.
Well, and he came over and saw Bunny in Fort Myers.
Yeah.
And I met him. He called me on the phone from Toronto to say that he couldn't come at Christmas time because he just had an operation for prostate trouble in Toronto, and be over later. And so, and they came across from New Orleans later on, and then I didn't see him again, I called him in Calgary when I was in there last fall.
Yeah.
And he was busy. He'd just come in from somewhere and going somewhere. Yeah. Else, you know. And but no sooner had I hung up the phone when it rang again, and here was Frank Ovens. Frank Ovens had been an old Signaler.
Yeah.
And he was secretary of the RCYC in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that Art was a member.
Yeah.
There, and a keen yachtsman, you see.
Yeah.
So Frank had just called him and in from Vancouver or something, and Art had told him I was in Calgary.
Yeah.
Too.
I'll be damned.
So I'll then, be damned. When I came out here, he called me a while ago and said he was coming over and would like to see me. So I was very glad to see him again.
Yeah. I think that you and Finn...
Well, he asked if I would get Finn. He had never met Finn before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Finn didn't know about him either.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I thought we did get it off the record here on the Charlie folks.
Yeah. Here. So what happens after you take this infantry training course in
London,
Ontario?
Yeah, well, do we start up again?
It's on now.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
oh.
I just left off.
Yes. I'm not sure of the detail. I went back to Ottawa, and I think I must have been there a year. I'm a little bit doubtful on the, there's a year kind of missing in there between me. But anyway, the next thing, I was asked if I would like to go and join the Hudson Straits expedition, which was going to start off in 1927. That was a combined Air Force and Marine Department expedition up to the Hudson Straits to check on the ice conditions in the straits with a view to navigation there.
Yeah.
See, they were toying with the idea of building either Churchill or Nelson.
Yeah.
They had already built a bridge and whatnot to go to Nelson, you see.
Yeah.
And but there was still some doubt about Churchill.
Yeah.
And apparently, only recently have I seen an account where they brought out a British fellow, and he unequivocally recommended Churchill.
Yeah.
So we didn't know that until we were up in the Straits. But anyway, they were organizing this thing with one of the captains of the Marine Department as a leader of the expedition, N.B. McLean.
Mm-hmm.
And there were to be three bases established, one at the eastern end, one at the western end of the Straits, and one in the middle as a headquarters place.
Yeah.
And they had six airplanes, two at each of these three bases. And they had chartered a freighter to carry up building materials to build our buildings and to carry the machines and knock down, you know, with their wings and cases and then fuselage in cases. And then all our coal for the winter and equipment and food for everybody, you see.
Yeah.
They had a bunch of stevedores on, a bunch of carpenters, and in addition to all the members of the expedition,
mm-hmm.
which were, the six flying officers, three doctors, and myself as a radio engineer for the Air Force, a radio engineer from the Marine Department, and an engineer and an operator for each of the three bases.
Yeah.
And then I had three NCOs and miscellaneous storemen and marine engineer or a radio engineer from the Marine Department and radio, and then they had a rigger for them putting up masts and so on.
Yeah.
So we had quite a gang.
Yeah.
And we assembled in Halifax, and before that, I didn't know about this history, but Tommy Lawrence, Air Vice Marshal Lawrence now, mm-hmm. was a squadron leader then, and he was the senior Air Force officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been at Ottawa, and he was consulted about the aircraft which they would take. They wanted a certain type. So he tells me they wanted a single float type.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. So they told him to go and get what he wanted then. And he chose the Fokker Universals, which were just then being built in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he decided on that. They were these twin float things,
mm-hmm.
with a fuselage. And the pilot sat out in front. The pilot sat out in front. Anyway, that was his choice. And I've had long conversations with Tommy, who was a very good friend of mine, only just last fall,
mm-hmm.
when we were having a signals dinner in Toronto, I called him up and we had lunch together and spent the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and got a lot of information that he didn't know and that I didn't know.
yeah, I'll bet.
But that was... that was quite a show.
Well, what sort of equipment are you using? But this would be about 1927, 28?
This was 1927. Yeah.
What sort of sets would you be using? The same sort of thing?
We used... we had modified an old wartime set that the Air Force had used. Same ones that they were using at High River in 1923. We modified those. Instead of having two or three pieces, we modified them into one unit.
Yeah.
And we had an air-driven generator, a little generator mounted on the side of the plane, the usual thing with...
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yes, with a little propeller on it, you know.
Yeah.
And...
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes.
I'll be damned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we had these sets with no receiving equipment in the planes. And then we had our own set of masts and a receiver,
yeah.
which each the operator, our own operators would
yeah.
run, you see.
Yeah.
And worked out very satisfactorily. Yeah. General Clark gave me a history of the Air Force radio the other day
yeah.
to read. And they described all that in that very, very well.
Yeah. Still using the key.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we could use the we did use the voice on that. Sometimes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh,
oh yes.
Well.
Oh yes.
And yeah. so your line of communication is primarily along the Hudson Strait.
Yeah.
For that summer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. of course we had the Marine Department. They put up standard. Equipment for communication between bases.
Yeah.
We didn't use the aircraft stuff for that at all.
Yeah.
They had quite good. And then we had a short wave set. There was one on the ship going up on the Stanley
mm-hmm.
for working back to Ottawa, and they worked to our RC signal station in Ottawa.
I see.
And so and then similarly at Wakeham Bay at our base station in the
yeah.
Hudson Straits.
Yeah. Well, this would be your first stay in the North in any degree of isolation for quite, well, this would be the first.
My first,
yeah,
my first
for
stay,
you,
yes.
Yeah.
My first stay,
and
yeah.
You mentioned bringing up fuel, enough fuel to last them a year and
yes.
all that. Were you up there for a year?
Well, we were, there was the intention that we might have to stay for 2 years.
Yeah.
And now, I think nearly everybody was asked to volunteer, but Lawrence tells me that he was never asked, he was
yeah.
detailed.
Yeah.
And he felt it rather keenly because he was a married man with children.
Oy.
And most of the others weren't.
Mm.
Well, all the others weren't. Warren
yeah.
was, but he wasn't supposed
yeah.
to be.
yeah.
And we had these base stations and there was quite a powerful station in addition to the shortwave at Port Burwell, and they could communicate way down the coast in Labrador with Labrador on the long waves.
Oh yeah.
On the
yeah.
long waves.
Yeah.
So it was an alternative way of getting out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. Well, how did you find that?
Well, we had very little trouble with the shortwave.
Yeah. But I mean, I was thinking really of the. Of you yourself.
The living conditions.
Out there for a year
oh.
or what have you.
Well, it was pretty cold in the wintertime.
God, I'll bet it would be.
At each station we had one or more natives working with us.
Yeah.
And there was usually one that went with them on a patrol.
Yeah.
I went out on patrol quite often with one of them.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. Living conditions were not too good, excepting that, our accommodations were all right, but the fellow who had arranged the food supply left a lot to be imagination.
Oh, boy. They always do. They always do.
But and we didn't get, not very often did we get any fresh food.
Yeah.
Occasionally some fish, once in a while we had some caribou.
Yeah.
All very acceptable.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. My teeth are just about at the end, and I'm going to
yeah.
just trim
yeah.
it. Let's see. No, we have a few more minutes. No, we don't. No, that's just about at the end. So I'll just run this through and
yeah.
flip it over, and that'll give your voice a... Ah!
on side
the Hudson Straits.
Side two of the street, side two of the street, side two of the of the tape.
Yeah. Well, you're up there for about a year, am I right there,
well,
on the Hudson Straits?
After a year, they decided there was enough of it, and they made all sorts of plans then for the radio engineer. They flew him down to make some surveys about some directing finding stations for other straits, you see, navigation.
Yeah.
And, it was pretty cold weather, and they had a lot of trouble. They had trouble with engines, you know. They had let the oil get cold. They were in trouble, and Flight Lieutenant Leach at Nottingham Island, he made a forced landing on the ice at one time. I've forgotten why, and I think stayed overnight there, and I guess got his torch out and put his thing over the engine and kept it warm, so he did get it started in the morning.
Good
and got
him.
Back.
Yeah.
But then at the other end, at Port Burrell, Flight Lieutenant Lewis, with a native and a mechanic, got lost in the fog one day, and they ended up 60 miles out in the Atlantic.
Boy.
And made a landing out of fuel and headed on east for a day. And I don't know how they got properly oriented. I presume that there was a lack of communication between the native and the pilot or something, whether they anyway, they were completely disoriented, and anyway, they came and got headed back, and they
did you put a sail on board the plane or what?
No, they had a rubber boat. And they had a rifle and sleeping bags, I guess, and they killed a seal, I know, and had something to eat. And 13 days later, they came into camp, led by some natives they had met on the Labrador coast down below us. So that was quite an experience.
I should say so. Did you have anything
and
like that yourself?
In the meantime, both Squadron Leader Leach, or Flight Lieutenant Leach and Squadron Leader Lawrence, they flew down to Burrell to help in the search. And Leach flew back, and Lawrence decided that he wanted to come back by dog team. If you know the geography around Ungava Bay, east from Port Burrell, the tip of Labrador, you see, then they come around Ungava Bay into the Hudson Straits again, and so he essayed to come back by dog team with his native that he'd taken with us from Wakeham. And so he told us when he was leaving and wanted somebody to meet him at a place called Payne Bay on the west side of the bay. And that was about, that was about three quarters of the way around for him. And so I went off with a native, a young fellow we had there, a brother of his, native, on a dog team on Good Friday of 1928 to meet him. And we met at Payne Bay within an hour of each other. I didn't know him or anybody else. I got snowblind. I had glasses on, but we ran into some terribly cold weather with sort of a sleety snow, and got in behind the glasses and so on, and so I couldn't see anything hardly. The young native had never been there before, but we got along pretty well. It was old perishingly cold. It must have been down about 40 below zero, I think. And we built our snow houses for about 4 days. And we didn't have quite enough dogs.
Yeah.
We had an awful time getting up a hill shortly the day after we left. Yeah, I'll never forget that. We just had to sit on our bottoms and dig our heels in and pull for all we were on this sleigh loaded down with about 500 or 600 pounds,
yeah,
dog food and one,
yeah,
thing and another.
Yeah. Oh, brother.
But anyway, the very next day, who should come in but Flying Officer Carr Harris with another plane from the headquarters base, the other pilot at our main base. He landed, I don't know where, but anyway, in the snow, and lots of snow. And so Lawrence decided that he was going to continue on by dog team. And Carr Harris was the pilot, and so he flew back, and he brought a motion picture photographer with him. And so he came back by dog team, and I flew back.
Yeah.
In an hour and a half, but I was back home. It took me four or five days to get there.
Yeah. Oh, brother. Oh, boy. Well, what did you do after that expedition?
Well, then we had a case of a native who was taken terribly ill, and they suspected a perforated ulcer or something like that. And the doctor didn't want to operate alone, so he thought he would like to have the fellow from Port Burwell. So he flew over, and the two of them went at this fellow, and I held a flashlight for him.
Oh, my.
And they opened him up, and oh boy, all you could see was a white mucus all over everything. So they just decided they'd sew him up again. And I nursed him. He occupied my bed then for about a month. And I was a nurse, and fed him and all the rest of it. And he recovered.
Bless my soul.
I got a picture of him sitting out on the steps there. He looked healthy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He went home and was all right after, I guess.
Dear God.
Nature's a great thing here,
oh,
right?
Sheesh.
Yeah. Well, then we decided that, they decided that we were going to fly home via the east coast of Hudson's Bay.
Yeah.
The west end of the straits,
yeah,
on the east coast of Hudson's Bay, down to Cochrane and down that way. And Lewis, the fellow who didn't have a plane, the other pilot, whose plane was lost, why, he was deputed to go and arrange for the gas cache,
yeah,
all down there through the Hudson's Bay or the Revillon,
yeah,
there. And the rest of us, one plane was Flight Lieutenant Cogill from the east base, the two planes from our base, and one of the planes from the Nottingham Island, and Flight Lieutenant Leach, the senior officer, he stayed there until we were ready to leave the next morning. And the next morning, the four of us were all taking off from a place called Eric Cove,
mm-hmm,
with the Hudson Bay Post in there.
Yeah.
And the waves were pretty choppy. And Carr Harris' plane, when we got off, we saw his plane with his wings floating on the water. And I think Ashton's plane, something was wrong with that.
Good God.
And when we were up in the air, it was just Lawrence and myself. When we were up in the air, I noticed that the from the float to the fuselage and up to the wing, the joint there on the fuselage holding the stays to the float and the wing,
yeah,
was hanging, flying loose out there. So I, there was a little sort of a pass through between the cabin and the pilot, you see.
Yeah.
So I gave him a note or something. I don't know if he could see it or not. Probably the wing was in the way. I told him what it was anyway. So he made a landing very close to shore, I can tell you. And we got down all right. And in the meantime, why, he had talked to the Nottingham Island base,
yeah,
and told Leach there that everything was all off and to stay there.
Yeah.
And asked them to get in touch with any ship coming in from Churchill, which they did. That same afternoon, there was a ship came in there and salvaged our plane and got them on board, and we went on board down the straits, and we transferred onto the Naskapi down at Burwell.
Good.
And I went home on that.
Good.
The
travel wasn't easy.
Oh, there was an ocean, a ship called the Ocean Raider. No, was it the Ocean Raider? The Raider or something. There was one went aground off up there at Burrell, and there was a lot of fuss about it the year before, and it was still there and one thing another, and so there were always ships going in and out there on this. So we were fortunate to get the Naskapi to coming out. The so-called icebreaker, the Stanley, that we went up on the year before, she went out late in the season, and she very nearly floundered down. They were just lucky to get her to go back on it.
Good God. Well, now that would be the end of your travels up in the Hudson's Bay.
That was the end of the Hudson's,
yeah,
Bay. There were quite a few of us came out on the Naskapi. I've got a good picture of them.
Yeah.
And we picked up, we took out with us from up there a couple of little Eskimo kids that they, I've forgotten under whose auspices they were brought out, some church auspices, and they went to this school at Lakefield, very well-known school at Lakefield, down Peterborough, and became the pictures and the star and all this sort of thing, became,
yeah,
quite famous kids,
yeah,
and never amounted to anything later on, I think.
Yeah.
So I heard.
Yeah. Bless myself.
The doctor, he went up the following year on the Naskapi as a doctor, medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went down to New York and studied tropical medicine. And I've never heard of him since, or hardly any of the other people,
yeah,
excepting the Air Force people whom I've seen at odd times. Oh, and the radio engineer, why, before I left, when we were in Halifax, Commander Edwards, who was the head of the radio branch in the Marine Department, said to me, well, he said, if anything should happen to Harold Waltz, the radio engineer with his department, if anything should happen to him, why, you're to take over, Bill. So, but there was no occasion for that. I later on had some differences of opinion with him.
I must say, it must have been a hell of a good way to save money. You'd have nothing to save money on up there. Not that you'd be earning,
yes,
a great deal.
Yes, everything was supplied,
yeah,
such as it was, you know.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I spent my time by trying to learn some of the language.
Oh, yeah, the native language.
The natives,
yeah.
And I picked up somewhere a book on Eskimo grammar from one of the post managers there, the Revion Frères.
Yeah.
The fellow named Father Peck,
mm-hmm,
who had written this years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite good, but very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And however, I I used to get talking to these fellows, and just by pointing, you know, I got the names of all the things, the clothes and boots and parts of the body and everything else.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I enjoyed meeting with them, and I was able to chew the rag a bit with them,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And on one occasion, I went out with this young fellow we had, the younger of the two brothers, and their oldest brother lived out about 40 miles up the straits.
Yeah.
At a place called, oh, I can't think of the name now. And but he was the boss boy up there. There weren't very many of them, but he was quite a very intelligent old chap, as his two brothers were. And we went up there for a load of dog feed. And so I stayed in their igloo all night.
Oh, yeah.
And ate frozen frozen trout, lake trout. One of the most delicious things I've ever had.
Is that right?
Oh, just absolutely marvelous. And I had my own sleeping bag, you see, and they were blathering away at night, and every once in a while I'd chime in and say, oh yes, or something like this, in Eskimo,
yeah.
And they would laugh and have a great fun.
I only have about a half hour before I have to get back, so
yeah. Well,
we better scoot on a little bit. You come back from there. And
after that, I came back, and then I was up at Borden the next winter, and
Borden was sort of your major base.
Oh, it was our base,
base,
and training place, you see.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I didn't do very much there. They gave me a visual course, which I failed, and then from there, I guess I went back to Ottawa, and that was 1929.
Mm-hmm.
29. In Ottawa, all this airmail business was blowing up. And I went down to Washington or New York a time or two with Major Steele, as he was, and we were looking into the question for the radio beacons for the airmail.
Ah, yeah.
And then also other communications. It was St. Hubert. The R-100 was coming out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking after that. And Marconi were building these radio beacon sets.
Yeah.
So I was there to check on them. It's about nearly all the winter of the summer of 1929 or 30 I spent down there. And
right, well, when you say spent down there, was that right with the company learning?
With the company.
How they were doing it.
They were testing some of this equipment before it was finally built, you see.
Yeah.
Out into what one of their engineers used to call the horse box.
The horse box.
Out at St. Hubert.
Oh, I see.
And we were building the equipment for the R-100.
Yeah.
They were putting up the tower, and they built their radio station on top of the administration building, and this sort of thing. And then I was getting equipment for that. Then in 1930, the R-100 came out, that was interesting. I fitted a radio receiver on board for directions, radio beacon to take them up to Ottawa.
Oh, yeah.
And then I turned it on down the St. Lawrence when they left. And they were kind enough to invite me for the trip.
Yeah.
Along with all the brass.
Yeah.
And that was very enjoyable.
That, I'll bet it must have been. I know you have a photograph of you.
Yes,
yeah.
And when we were up waiting to go into Toronto, I was in the radio office talking to Bill Lockhart up at Camp Borden.
Oh, yeah. Oh, bless my soul. Well, now, you say you're talking to him this time.
Yes. Oh, on the key.
Oh, I see,
yeah.
I see, yeah. Yeah.
They did have voice on it, too.
Yeah.
But for short work, you see.
Yeah.
For when they were mooring and so on.
Yeah.
But as soon as he left, I went out to Regina. made my headquarters out there. And we were building radio beacon stations at Brandon, Regina, Lethbridge, and Red Deer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Maple Creek in Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking after the construction of all those places, and I had NCOs, a senior NCO who was a good mechanic at each one of them, and he had somebody to help him too. And we arranged, the buildings were put up by the engineers.
Mm-hmm.
They arranged for that, and I think the Canadian Bridge Company put the towers up for us, and and when the equipment came along, as soon as it was, the building was available, we installed that, the motors and generators and all the rest of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then when we got some of them sort of in operation a bit, I got an Air Force plane out there for me to do some calibrating and see what was going on at some distance, you know. In the meantime, I had what we called a field strength meter to go out and gave the intensity of the signal out at various places around.
Yeah.
I had a Ford car that I could get about with,
mm-hmm.
and then I frequently flew with the civil aviation people. Dan McLean was the inspector there, and Squadron Leader Tuttle was the chief inspector of airways in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
He was frequently out there, and sometimes I flew for one. On one occasion, later on, we got those things working to a point, not entirely satisfactory, but they were using them on planes of Western Canadian Airways, is it, or something like that, started it out, and the pilots were using them, and we had at least weather reports for them. And they were fitted with receivers.
Yeah.
And well, then that all fell through in 1932.
With the Depression, you mean?
With the Depression. They were all closed down. And so we boarded them up and left.
Oh,
and I went down to Ottawa. Oh, before we left, I had a letter from Colonel Ford in Ottawa. And Colonel Ford wanted to know if I would be willing to take on the job as district signal officer in Regina, as well as my job there, you see. And I kind of blew my top when I got this. And I wrote to him and I said, well, this fellow there, all the interest he has in my work is to bring his girl around on a Sunday afternoon, so I am not very interested in taking on his job as well as my own, which I'm terribly busy. Next thing I knew, I got two civilian engineers out to help me.
Ah, well.